Okay, Mo'adim u'simcha, everybody. Hope everyone is well, having a nice Pesach. At least on a personal level, it's been a hard Pesach for Klal Yisrael, but please God, we should hear good news, besurot tovot, and good things that we can have the Geula Shlema. Okay, why do we have a holiday on the seventh day of Pesach? Why don't we start Pesach, as we discussed, as a holiday of questions? So why is the seventh day of Pesach a holiday? Some don't be afraid to answer. It's not such a hard question.
Red Sea, crossing the Red Sea.
Crossing the Red Sea, good. That's the answer I was hoping to get. That may or may not be true. Like many things, it's never mentioned in the Torah that it happened on the seventh day of Pesach. There's no indication that we crossed on the seventh day. We know we crossed. Paro chased us. It took 3 days to chase us. We know exactly when that was. Moreover, even if we would know it was today, the Torah has no, Torah does not make a, yeah, we have Az Yashir, but the Torah doesn't make it a permanent holiday, like so many things in our Torah, like Matan Torah, that's the big one we've mentioned in the past. The Torah doesn't tell us when Matan Torah happened. And there's no holiday in the Torah itself, at least in the written Torah, to celebrate the giving of the Torah. In the Torah, Shavuot is purely agricultural. There's no holiday to celebrate the falling of the man. Which holidays or which miraculous events or which events get holidays and which don't is a fascinating subject. But it appears to be, as we'll discuss, develop hopefully, it's really just the Exodus and coming to Israel. Those are really the only two sort of historical events we celebrate on a permanent basis as holidays. The man, for example, so the man is the origin of Shabbat. The first mention that there's a notion of Shabbat comes by the man, that they're told not to collect on Shabbat. But the Torah never, ever links the reason we keep Shabbat to the man. That was like a halakha. The man you can't take on Shabbat. But later on, in the Aseret HaDibrot, the reasons given are either because God created the world in 6 days, or that we were slaves in Egypt, or what in the laning we read yesterday, in order that your slave should rest, that a social reason. The Torah never connects the observings of Shabbat to the man. So there is no there's no connection, at least on a Torah level, between the crossing of the sea and the seventh day of Pesach. And just like eating matzah, the idea that the first day of Pesach and the seventh day of Pesach is Yontif, that's mentioned in the Torah at the beginning of the 12th chapter in Shemot, before we left Egypt. In other words, we're going to have a 7 day festival, and we discussed it last week or whatever, a couple weeks ago, how matzah is not necessarily or not only connected to leaving Egypt in the hurry, or I'd say it's primarily not connected to leaving. That's sort of a small component of it. That was our shiur a couple weeks ago. So the 7 day is Yontif is because Yontif, that, that's a broader question, that whenever we have two major festivals in the year. Two major festivals are Pesach and Sukkot. Why do I say that? Why do I pick on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Shavuot? What do I have against them? Well, what Pesach and Sukkot are the two main holidays. What about all the other holidays? So, first of all, just our whole, the fact that they're a week long, the fact that they're much longer, they have Yontif, Chol HaMoed Yontif, the fact that really, if you think about it, really what, Rosh Hashanah, we have no idea why it's a holiday, right? The Torah gives no indication. There's no historical event that we are aware of. Even the fact that the world was created in Rosh Hashanah, I don't want to like get anybody all excited, but I think it's important to distinguish between what's in the Torah, what's in the Pshat, and what later on, how the rabbis developed certain things. That's very important too. We follow how the rabbis developed it, but it's important to distinguish between what's a later development and how the rabbis are reading into the holiday and what it says in the Torah itself. So Rosh Hashanah, we know there's a debate in the Talmud itself between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar. Was the world created in Nisan? Makes sense. Or Tishrei. In other words, Nisan and Tishrei are the two major points of the year, 2 months of the year. Our months begin at Nisan and our year begins at Tishrei. That's Pesach and Shavuot, right? We have to combine the two. Our months and years have to be in sync, But the beginning of the year is in Tishrei, and the beginning of the months are in Nisan. That already tells you there's something special about these 2 months, which is really when our holidays happen, with the exception of Shavuot. But Rosh Hashanah seems to be that we mentioned in the past, it's the importance of the number seven, that everything seven has holiness, 7 days, 7 years, seven times 7 years. That's why Pesach is 7 days, Sukkot is 7 days, Hashavah Brachas is 7 days, etc. So we need something. The seventh month has to be holy. And presumably, the simple reading of the blowing of the shofar, it's always to make an announcement. We have that in Parsha Palocha. When you want to gather the people, Titka'u, you blow the chatzotroit, you blow the shofar, you gather the people. So it's an announcement. What are we announcing? And this is the seventh month. This is the month we're going to focus on our relationship with God. And Sukkot is coming. Now, Yom Kippur and Sukkot are coming. But really, it's the holiday of Sukkot, which is the one holiday known in rabbinic literature as Chag. When the rabbis say the term Chag, holiday, it refers to the holiday of Sukkot. That's the culminating holiday. That's the pinnacle of the holiday. We begin at Pesach, we end at Sukkot. So Rosh Hashanah is sort of an announcement, I would say. What's Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur, in many ways, I don't want to say it's a sad holiday. We know the rabbis tell us Yom Kippur is the happiest day of the year because we renew our relationship with God. We renew our relationship with other people. That's why the custom was to go out on dates, basically. They had a singles party. That's what the Mishnah says, but Yom Kippur is a result of sin. Had we not sinned at the Chet Egel, there wouldn't be a Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we shouldn't have needed it. Shavuot is really the continuation of Pesach. And the Ramban explains that really the period of Sfiras HaOmer, it's another problem. The period of Sfiras HaOmer is supposed to be a happy time. Now it's supposed to be happy time. And it's the link between Pesach and between the leaving Egypt and receiving of the Torah or whatever, if you want to, and that's not true in the Torah. See, I'm putting in the rabbinic idea that the Sfiras HaOmer links the physical freedom and spiritual freedom. It's a beautiful idea, very important idea, but that idea is not the way it's presented in the Torah. In the Torah, the Sfiras HaOmer is presented as from the beginning of the barley harvest. That's what Omer is. The Omer, the Korban HaOmer had to come from barley because that was the first grain that ripened. So they would harvest that at Pesach time. I mentioned over Pesach, I don't know if anybody saw, there was an article last week how Karaite, like Judaism, is becoming more popular. So whatever, it was an interesting article. So it mentioned some guy was going to see if the barley grains had ripened because they won't observe Pesach until the barley comes. So that's otherwise you have to make it a leap year. You have to wait. That's the Korban HaOmer. That's what is one of the ways we look if it's going to be a leap year or not. They don't have a fixed calendar. So in the Torah, the Sfiras HaOmer links Pesach, the barley harvest, to the wheat harvest. And if you want to put it in halakhic terminology, the prohibition of chadash, that you can't eat the grain planted anytime after Pesach till the Pesach passes over, has become a popular law today. Most bakeries today serve only quote unquote all flour, gashan flour. So that's the halakha. That halakha still applies today. It's but from that time. And the shtei halechem, the two loaves of bread that they brought on Shavuot, allowed the new wheat to be brought in the Beit HaMikdash. That's the way it's presented in the Torah. Later rabbinic authorities, whatever, the way we present it when we teach our kids, when we were taught in school, is combines, and we're counting, like the Sefer HaChinuch says, we're counting from the Exodus to the receiving of the Torah. It's very nice, very nice, but it's not how the Torah presents it. So in the Torah itself, so the Ramban says basically Shavuot is the culmination of a Pesach. It's the last day of Pesach, which would explain why Pesach is only 7 days. Well, that's a question. Sukkot is 7 days plus one, right? 8 days, right? Rosh Hashanah, Tishrei, Stone Holiday. And Pesach is also basically 7 days plus one, the day of Shavuot. Since, it's a long break, they got basically 6 weeks from the end of Pesach to the beginning of Shavuot. So the seventh day was made, it appears to me, the seventh day was made, a Yontif. Hoshana Rabbah is not made a Yontif because we're going to have Hoshana Rabbah as a yontif. We're going to have that, we're going to have, you know, Shmini Atzeret as a yontif. So they, there was no reason, in a sense, to make Hoshana Rabbah. In other words, the last day of Sukkot is just a regular day, Chol HaMoed. The last day of Pesach is a yontiv, but it's part of Pesach. There's no Shechianu. Right? It means that there's no Shechianu. There's no Shechianu on Hoshana Rabbah either. Just the Shechianu is on Shmini Atzer. But that's basically what you have. You have these two basic holidays, Pesach, which begins on the 15th of Nisan and ends sort of on the 6th of Sivan. And because, the freedom is very nice, but we want a purpose to our freedom. Or the barley harvest is very nice, but barley harvest is only for animals. Animals eat barley. That's the assumption of the Torah. Humans don't eat barley. And humans eat wheat. And that, of course, you can combine the two, just having freedom without any purpose of the Torah. We're like animals. It's the Torah that takes us from being animals into human beings. That's a very, important concept. The rabbis don't make up this stuff. It's based. It's very beautiful, but it's important to know what's written in the Torah and how we, what are the midrashim or whatever word you want to use, how we develop these themes into the way the holidays are celebrated nowadays. Obviously, agricultural holidays don't make so much sense in New York and in Toronto and in Poland and in Germany. And even today in Israel, they're not really fully celebrated because we don't have a temple, the agricultural stuff related to the Beit HaMikdash also. But we basically have these two holidays, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is because there was a blip in our history. Unfortunately, we built a golden calf, so we needed forgiveness. Beautiful. That's built in. The Midrash goes so far as to say that was created before the world was created. Before, in other words, 10 things God created before he created the world. One of them is, Tshuva. The world cannot exist without repentance. We're human beings and we sin. But fundamentally, Yom Kippur is sort of a blip, an unfortunate blip in the holiday. Now, I just want to point out, I don't know if we mentioned it before, that Shavuot is really an adjunct to Pesach. That's what we're saying. That it's the, first of all, you look in the Torah, it's the 50th day. There is no independent day. We all know that. Usfartem lachami makarat haShabbat. We count for 49 days and the 50th day is Shavuot. So the Shavuot is right away linked to Pesach. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, there are no Hilchot Shavuot. It's part of Hilchot Pesach. It's under the rubric of Hilchot Pesach is the Yontif of Shavuot. Did I ever tell you the cute story of the Vilna Gaon learning Shavuot? Anybody know that story? I don't know. Okay. So they say that the Vilna Gaon on Pesach one year, when he was how these stories go. When he was, 5 or 7 or 6 months, I don't know how old he was, when the Vilna Gaon, they tell the story in the Vilna Gaon, that he picked up a Masechet Shavuot on Pesach. And he said he wants to prepare for the holiday of Shavuot. So he's going to learn Masechet Shavuot. And he's going to learn that for the holiday, for Shavuot. So they they laughed at him. They said, no, you don't understand. The holiday, the Masechet and the Talmud of Shavuot is not about the holiday of Shavuot. It's about a Shavuot. It's about an oath. It's the laws of oath. What happens when you take an oath? It's not, he thought Shavuot, it's the same. Well, so the Vilna Gaon said, what are you talking about? Of course I knew that. But Masechet Shavuot is 49 dafim. They're 49 dafim. That's the beginning of Daf Yomi. And we're all Mushba V'Omid V'Har Sinai. We all took an oath at Mount Sinai to keep the Torah. So there's no more appropriate way to prepare for Shavuot than to learn the holiday about oaths, because we are bound by an oath to keep the Torah. No, that's the story they say in the Vilna Gaon as a little kid learning Shavuos between Pesach and Shavuot. But really, Pesach and Shavuos are the one holiday, and Sukkot is the other holiday. And I'll just show it to you three times. I think it's so fascinating. If we're going to take a look how the goal of the Exodus is presented three times. We'll take a look three different times in the Chumash, and three times should be a chazaka, good enough to, prove it. Everybody see the screen? Okay. So if you look here in Brit Ben Haftarim, the beginning of the whole story, when God comes to Abraham and he makes a covenant with him, and he says, you should know that your descendants will be slaves in a foreign land for 400 years. And I'm going to punish those who oppress us. You're going to leave with a lot of money. The Torah makes a big deal about that, going off the gold and silver. And that you will die in peace. That's God talking to Abraham. And Dor Revi'i Yeshuvu Hena, the fourth generation will come back to the land of Israel. There's not one mention of getting a Torah. The Brit Ben Aftarim is to go from Egypt to the land of Israel. It doesn't mention a word about receiving the Torah in between. You have the same idea when God first appears to Moshe at the burning bush. So he introduces himself. I'm your Lord, your God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moshe was very nervous. He turned away. What's going on here? Right. And God says to Moshe, I see the suffering of your people. And they read, let's see, lo, I'm going to come and save the people from Egypt and bring them from the land of Egypt to this wonderful land. But there's no mention that you're going to go to Har Sinai. That only comes later on when Moshe says, oh, what's going on? Why are the people going to believe me? Who are you? What's going on? So then God says, okay, here's the sign. You know, you'll come and you worship me at Mount Sinai, but it doesn't say Mount Sinai, but you'll come. But God doesn't say anything about going to getting the Torah. It's going from Egypt to the land of Israel. And then just for one last thing, this, of course, is the question of the Chacham, the way the Haggadah understands the question of the Haggadah, of the Chacham, in the context of the Torah and Sefer Dvarim, is question has nothing to do with Pesach. It's a generic question when your child will ask you, why do you have to keep all the mitzvot? And you should say, we were slaves to Egypt, and God took us out with a strong hand, and he did all these wonderful miracles. And why did he take us out? Leman. The word leman always is for the purpose of, for the sake of. The key means because, like this happened because. Leman is what's the purpose of it happening. But leman, why did God take us out of Egypt? In order that he should bring us into the land of Israel. It doesn't say in order that he should give us a Torah. So this, of course, is... I think that sort of proves the point well enough. It's really quite fascinating. The giving of the Torah is, I don't want to say, God forbid, it's an afterthought. And we have all the Midrashim, God looked in the Torah before he created the world and everything. But when Moshe, when God is saying the reason he's taking us out of Egypt, it has nothing to do with, it's not in order to get the Torah, it's in order to go to the land of Israel. Why do we get the Torah? The simple reading of the Chumash is we get the Torah so we'll know how to live our life when we go to Israel. The Torah constantly contrasts Egypt and Israel, and don't follow the ways of the Egyptians. And okay, how do you not follow them? So they had bad sexual ethics. So we're going to read this on Yom Kippur. So here's the laws of sexual ethics. They had bad business ethics, right? We've done that a few times, right? Have honest wage because I took you out of Egypt. That's why I took you out of Egypt. The Torah is the guide how to set up a country that has the great science of Egypt, right? That has the great, that's why we had to go to Egypt to see the wonderful, to see a really advanced country. But unfortunately, the advancements in science and technology and archaeology and everything else didn't go hand in hand with advancement in morality, which we see all the time in history. And therefore, you're going to have the Torah. But the Torah in many ways seems to be a means to an end in that sense. Like the Torah is the, we have to stop at Mount Sinai on the way to Israel in order to figure out how to live. But the Brit Ben Aftarim and God coming to Moshe, it's not about getting the Torah. I think that's a very, listen, today this is a huge debate, whatever you want to call it. Is the Torah sort of a means to an end? Is the Torah, you live your life, you go work, you do whatever everybody else does, you live like human beings live. And the Torah is a guide for how to live. That's, I think that was a very common approach. Today, and you have much more, gaining a lot of adherence, is the approach, no, the goal of life is Torah. You know, you bring all kinds of things. How do interpreted, no, life is to learn Torah. It's not you live a normal life and Torah is your guide. Torah is life. So whatever, but I think it's pretty, obviously the Torah has all these laws, you know, about business and farming. The Torah expects people to live a regular life. Obviously the idea of learning on a regular basis, and that's not our discussion, but that's really not the way the Torah has been understood for all these years. Okay. Anyway, so that's a little bit. So the seventh day of Pesach is probably the Torah wants a Yontif at the end. We don't want to end on a Yom Kippur. Yontif is a greater connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the seventh day, and we're told that before we left Egypt, before we ate matzah, because we were in a hurry, before we crossed the sea, that we're going to have a seven-day festival. Again, seven, of course, being a very important number, seven, a number of completeness and et cetera. And that's why there's a seventh day. Later on, we attach the seventh day to give it some sort of oomph. And again, I'm not saying it isn't true, but we attached a little bit to the notion of crossing the sea, and therefore we read Az Yashir on the seventh day, and that's how we sort of acknowledge it. But it's important to know it's Yontif has its independent mitzvah, it's its own independent importance. Okay, I just want to spend any questions, comments? Okay, I just want to spend. I'll be one more thing before I do that. When we say that Shmini Atzeret is the last day of Sukkot, you know, the famous midrash that God says, Kasheh alai predatkem, it's hard for me to separate from you. We've had this intense time together, you know, Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, which is going to end, Hoshana Rabbah. So Shmini Atzeret, the midrash says, has no purpose. Just to, I mean, maybe it's the ultimate purpose, just to revel in our relationship with God. That's why there are no mitzvot. It's just to be in the presence of God. And that's why the rabbis interpret the expression, v'hayita ach sameach, which is written by Sukkot, that you should be sort of, ach means only happy, right? Ach is always an exclusionary term. Ach besor l'chodesh. However, it excludes something. V'yit v'sam v'yita ach sameach. So the rabbis interpret that verse as a reference to Shmini Atzeret, that on Sukkot we have all these other mitzvot, and Shmini Atzeret there are no mitzvot. The only mitzvot is to be in God's presence. And as we've mentioned many times, the name of Rav Soloveitchik, whose 30th yortzeit was a couple of days ago, the ultimate in simcha is to be in the presence of God. That's what simcha means. And Yontif is an elevated level of simcha over on Shabbat, because on Yom Tov we go to the Beit HaMikdash, we go to God's place, we're in the presence of God, v'samachta lifnei Hashem, that the ultimate simcha is being in the presence of God. And Shmini Atzeret is the ultimate, in a sense, all day. We don't need any mitzvah, just being, you know, I don't want you to leave, just hang around for an extra day, and let's joy together. And that, of course, later on, simchat, much, much later on, like hundreds of years after the close of the Talmud, that's the day that becomes associated with the completing of the Torah, Simchat Torah, just the pure joy of the Torah. However, I think it's important to note that Shmini Atzeret is not really just the last day of Sukkot or the end of Sukkot. It's the end of the holiday season. It relates to Pesach too. When God says, Kasheh alai predatchem, it's really beginning from Pesach and Shavuot. Not just, we think of it, okay, the from Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. It's the whole thing. The holiday season. The holiday season begins in the spring, continues in the summer, and the commentaries point out, why is Shavuot only one day? So I said already, because it's the last day of Pesach, right? It's really the concluding day of Pesach with 7 weeks in the middle. True. Additionally, why else? I don't know if it conflicts or if they work together. The commentators point out, because you can't take a week off in the summer. A farmer can't afford to take a week off in the summer. I mean, and Shavuos, remember, purely agricultural. Well, the Torah is always a very practical book, right? That's, you have to keep that in mind. Torah is meant to be very practical, not meant to drive you nuts, right? That's why when people clean too much over Pesach or all the other things they do, it's not the Torah wants you to be normal, right? I remember how I don't know, how much matzah do people eat over at the Seder? I'm just curious. How big is your olive? How big is your, yeah. So you have a very big olive. I don't know, you know, olive, like how big is olive? It's, by the way, you don't have to eat an olive. So you have to eat kit zayit. Very important to point out, eat a kit zayit. You don't need a zayit. And then, I mean, you don't need matzah the size of an olive. Approximately a kit zayit. You don't have to measure. That's the whole point. It's a kit zayit. It's like a zayit, because in the Torah, we didn't have exact measurements because they lived in a pre-scientific age. So an amah was between an elbow and the middle finger. Well, that's great, but everybody's elbow to middle finger is long. A tefach is a hand breadth, right? A sukkah has to be 10 tefachim, 10 hand breadths. Well, how much is that? I assume, I'm saying maybe it sounds radical, I'm assuming, well, it depends who you were, because if you were short, the 10th, your sukkah could be a little bit smaller than your tall neighbor. The 10th bakim would be a few inches taller. Why? Because the Gemara itself says 10th bakim is the minimum height that you can squeeze into an area. Well, the bigger you are, the bigger area you need. So it makes sense. There is no, a tefach isn't 3.4 inches. It's a tefach. It's a hand breadth. And everybody has a different tefach. Probably same thing with Amad. All these things. They didn't have exact measurements. They didn't have the ability or the wherewithal. They didn't care. So you ate a kizayit. You ate around the sides of an olive. Today, we live in a scientific era. So everything got to be measured out exactly. And the olives grew, whatever. They shrunk. And et cetera. But, and then how long do you eat the kizayit? How long? You have to eat a kizayit a day, achila press. And the amount of time it takes to eat, like a press is half a loaf of bread. Like it's a normal thing. So what happens is people take a kizayit, like it's, 8x8, a whole matzah. And then they say, well, kidei achila pras, there's some opinions, 9 minutes, 4 minutes, 2 minutes. So they stuff their face, and some people say you have to have two kizaitim for the motzi matzah. So they take two pieces of matzah, and they eat it within 2 minutes, and they almost choke. And you probably do not fulfill the mitzvah if you do that. Because matzah has to be eaten like a normal human being. The reason we say kidei achila pras is because it has to be eaten as normal people eat, is eat at a normal pace. Again, could they, how long it takes to eat a meal, half meal? Well, that varies. That's the point. They're not exact measurements here. Anyways, the Torah is meant to be very practical, very normal. So the holiday of Shavuot as an agricultural festival cannot be more than one day. Okay. I just want to spend a few minutes on Sfira, and then I want to talk a little bit, since it's in, normally there's a class on the Siddur, we'll talk maybe the few minutes we have left, we'll talk a little bit about Musaf on the Shalosh Regalim. Okay, so I mentioned the idea of Sfira, of course, is meant to be a happy time, and we're celebrating, it's a much longer Chol HaMoed, but it's a longer Chol HaMoed. So what happens, I've asked, people here, ask everybody, why did Sfira turn into a period of mourning? So what's the answer everybody knows?
The answer is supposedly that all of these disciples of Rabbi Akiva, who's the sacred rabbi,
so why do you say supposedly?
And they died. It doesn't make any sense.
What doesn't make sense?
That so many that disciples of Rabbi Akiva would have been so bad to each other that they would have died from that, and that 2,000 years later we'd have this 7 week period that's sad instead of being this
right. So there is a lot of literature exactly. Okay, why don't we take a quick look at the Gemara? I hope I have it up here. I think I do. Take a look at the Gemara. Yevamot 62b. So first of all, it's very interesting. The sugya, the very brief discussion about what happened in Sfirat Homer, it's a very brief discussion, is in Masechet Yevamot, as you see here. Yevamot 62b. And the Mishnah here is discussing the mitzvah of Pru Urvu. That Alam lo yivatel adam ipru v'revia, you're not allowed to stop having kids until you have at least two kids. Beit Shammai says you have to have two sons. Beit Hillel says you have to have a son and a daughter. So it's in the context of this discussion about the mitzvah of pru v'revu that you have the following discussion. Because the Gemara says like this, Nasad isha biyalduto, yisa isha bizignuto. Even if you get married when you're young, say your wife passes away or whatever, you should marry when you get older. Hayulo banim biyalduto, you had kids when you were young, have kids when you're older. Baboker, zarad, zarecha, this is a pasuk, I believe, in Shir Hashirim. No, it's in Kohelet. In the morning, you should plant your seeds, ula erev al tanach yadecha, but don't let it go at night. That's, of course, the Gemara is interpreting, have kids when you're young, have kids when you're old. That fits in with the Mishnah. So Rabbi Akiva, now the great one who spent 24 years learning, right? Lamad Torah b'yalduto, you learn Torah in your youth. You should learn Torah when you're older. It's not just your kids. When you're older, we're busy, right? When you're younger, you have more time to learn Torah. Hayulo talmidim b'yalduto, you had students when you were young. Yeah, you should teach Torah in your old age. That's what keeps older people going, teachers going. But okay, quote the same pasuk. Then they say, "Amru shneimus or elim zukim tell me the mayulul Rabbi Akiva." So Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. So there's something very fascinating and a little bit strange about this concept. What do you mean at 12,000 pairs? I don't know. Why didn't he have 24,000, students? Now, I think I don't think that number, again, remember numbers in the Torah and for sure in rabbinic literature are not always accurate. They're symbolic, right? We've given many examples of that over many shiurim, that numbers, they're not like, they're connected in some point, but you don't have to take numbers so literally, especially in the Gemara itself, but even in the Torah itself. So it's probably connected to the fact that the rabbis say that Rabbi Akiva learned for 24 years. Now, Rabbi Akiva didn't learn for 24 years. I mean, he learned for 12 years and 12 years, right? You know, the famous, the story is Rabbi Akiva went away to learn. His wife wouldn't marry him. He had to go learn. Whole beautiful story about how they met and they fell in love with her. And her father disowned them, Kalva Savua, disowned Rabbi Akiva Rachel because who would marry some ignoramus who didn't know Aleph Beit at the age of 40. So he went to, she sold her hair. She had to cut her hair so they can sell it to make money. And he went away for 12 years. And after 12 years, he came back. And the neighbor's saying to Rabbi Akiva, what a terrible husband. He goes away for 12 years. He leaves him, which, by the way, is true. If you're not Rabbi Akiva, you're right. That would be a terrible thing to go away for 12 years, 100%. Rabbi Akiva was an exception, like Moshe Rabbeinu was an exception. We know Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva are compared. They both lived 120, all kinds of comparison. Moshe at Har Sinai goes to meet Rabbi Akiva, that famous Midrash, where God says, why are you putting the letter? So Moshe transports him to Rabbi Akiva's Beit Midrash. What's the rabbi's teaching? There's a lot of parallels between Rabbi Akiva and Moshe. Moshe gave us the Torah, and as we're going to see, Rabbi Akiva gave us the Torah that we have. And the same way Moshe had to separate from his wife, so too Rabbi Akiva separated from his wife. This is not for us. This is not for anybody else. So he came 12 years. I don't care if we go back another 12 years. So it's the same idea, 12,000 pairs like this, 12 twice. I don't know for sure, but this is what I guess these 24,000 students in these 24 years and the 12 divided into two is what's going on. And the guard says, "Kulam meitu b'perikachat." They all died at one point. So this is the key lesson. They didn't honor one another. Can you imagine rabbis not honoring one another? The greatest of rabbis. That's why I believe that the reason Rabbi Akiva says the most important verse in the Torah is to love your neighbor as yourself, after l'recha kamocha, is because of this, because he saw is even great. I don't want to say even great rabbis cannot honor. Tragically, I think sometimes you have to say especially great rabbis. Often you find that somehow people who are less excellent don't have as much difficulty honoring one another. You know, it's great, like in the universities, often the great jealousy between scholars and Torah and science. It's the way of the world. It's kind of very sad, but that's what the Gemara is saying. It's hard to believe, but that's what the Talmud says. Whether you take it literally or not, 12,000, they all died because they didn't give honor to one another. So that's the context of the Gemara, that you should learn. You should have kids when you're young, learn when you're young. And then the Gemara says, it's not about that's why we mourn. The world was desolate. Acheba Rabbi Akiva, here's the point. Rabbi Akiva was old now. He gave up. What, I'm going to start over again? That's really, really hard. Eitzer Rav Otena Shevet Aram, and he taught them Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, Rav Yossi, Rav Shimon, Rav Elazar ben Shemua. The Haim, these are the people who recreated Torah. Torah could have been lost after the Hadrianic persecutions. Torah could have been lost. And that's the context of the Talmud. Always teach again. The Torah that we have today is from Rabbi Akiva, willing to teach after all the students had died, after the terrible tragedy went through. This is a very common Jewish thing we had this week, unfortunately. After a great tragedy, we build, we keep going. And then the Gemara adds as a postscript. You should know they died between Pesach and Atzeret, right? Pesach and Shavuot. The Gemara didn't say that before. It just said they died at one time. And that was sort of a postscript to the story. Kula made to meet the Rav. Fine. Very nice. And then the Gemara goes on to a new discussion. Whoever isn't married, doesn't have joy, doesn't have, because that's the context of the Gemara. Okay, but you notice the Gemara says absolutely nothing about that we should mourn for that. The Gemara doesn't say there. It's like when the Gemara talks on the 9 days. So the Gemara, there is no 9 days in the Gemara. The Gemara talks on Shavuot Shekalbo. The Mishnah, in fact, before Tisha B'Av, Mishnah Nasav and Mati B'Simcha, the Gemara gives us guidelines how we have to mourn. Can't have wine the meal before the fast on Tisha B'Av, etc. But the Gemara never says that we mourn because the students of Rabbi Akiva died. And many of the scholars saying, some rabbinic scholars do say, what do you mean they died at the same time? They were killed in the Bar Kokhba revolt, all kinds of reasons. That's not, did they die of natural causes or were they killed in the war? Remember, Rabbi Akiva is the big supporter of Bar Kokhba. That's what a lot of say. And anyways, we know, especially with Agadot, you have to read them not in a literal sense, and they can have different layers of meaning. And I know it doesn't really matter. It's the message of the story that counts. So yes, we say we mourn because of Rabbi Akiva's death, and that could very well be later on. It could be as the exile went on and on and on and on and on, so it got a lot worse. I will say Danny Sperber in his book on Minhagei Yisrael claims that it wasn't so much betrayed the death of Rabbi Akiva. They added that on. It was the Crusades. The Crusades, as we know, we have eyewitness testimony, and if you'll remember on Tisha B'Av, when we read the keynote on the Crusades, it actually has the actual dates. Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the 23rd of Iyar, I think. It says specific dates, and that appears to be when the Sfira period became a mourning time. That's when Avarachmin got introduced. That Avarachmin that we say today, pretty much every Shabbos in Shul, got introduced at that time period in history, and that could be. But what Sfira is supposed to be is the time of great joy. And unfortunately, because of historical circumstances, it hasn't worked out the way. But that's what it's meant to be. Okay, just one last thing I'll say about the Pesach and Sukkot, I guess, which I should have mentioned earlier, is really, I mentioned last week that Pesach is the holiday of asking questions. Ki yishal chabin chan. Sukkot is the holiday of knowledge, the man yedu. But you should know. That's a higher level, of course. But also, what we were claiming, all the sources show that the goal of the Exodus is come to the land of Israel. The Torah is the mechanism to get there. But, the goal is to get to Israel. And that's what Sukkot is, the journey to Israel. So that's why Sukkot is really a greater holiday. It is celebrated on a greater level than on Pesach. Most obvious that we say Hallel every day, the full Hallel. The Hallel we say on Pesach, only half Hallel. We've discussed that in the past. The Korbanot were different. That's also a sign. It's Man Simchatenu. The notion of Simcha is not even mentioned on Pesach. It may halachically apply. We take it from Sukkot applied to Pesach. But the fact that the Torah writes about Simcha on Shavuos once and on Sukkot twice, but never on Pesach, is quite indicative. And the fact that it's called Man Simchatenu when it's Chag, because the goal of the Exodus is to get to the land of Israel. But it's interesting, that's what I mentioned, I think, earlier. We don't have a holiday to celebrate the arrival in Israel. We have a big holiday, what they're in the middle of, when we leave Egypt. That's a big holiday. Pesach, that's a biggie. But why is there no holiday when we arrived in Israel? On Yud Nisan, I think they arrived in Israel, right? 40 years later. Why is there no holiday? If the goal is to get to Israel, that's ultimately. So even said, that's the same question a little bit about Sinai. So we've discussed that, right? Why Sinai? Why the giving of the Torah is not mentioned as a separate holiday, at least in the Torah? So the way we're explaining it now, this is sort of the means to the end, right? Or
why did it took so long to capture that?
Oh, so you're saying it took so long. So I think you're on to, I think that's the answer, really. In other words, the answer is we haven't really arrived yet. In other words, we arrived, but the goal is to arrive in Israel, set up a state that is a model for the world, that the world is going to say, Dihi chachmatchem ubinatchem, one of the most important verses in the Torah, Devarim 4:6, I won't go now, that you should keep the Torah, we've discussed in the past, because it's our wisdom and understanding in front of the nation, Vamru, Rak chacham be'navon ha'goy ha'gadol, is that the world has to see how smart we are, and the Gemara interprets that's why we have to study science, because whatever the world considers smart, Jews have to be the best at. That's what it says in the Gemara. So we haven't fully arrived in Israel. We arrived, then we left, we got exiled. So we left Egypt. That's done. We don't go back to Egypt. But
the conquest of Israel was actually never completed.
That's what I'm saying. That's my point.
In the times from Yeshua, even in the times from
Yeshua. Yeah, okay, so they didn't capture all of Israel, right? David and Melch, yeah. And the Baich,
How can you celebrate? Half a job?
No, we do celebrate half a job. Otherwise, we couldn't celebrate Yom HaTzmut. No. We do believe. Judaism doesn't believe that you have to have complete redemption to save anything. No, that's a beautiful, we give that. That's Dayenu. What's Dayenu? The theme of Dayenu is we thank you. What do we mean? It wouldn't be enough. We end the story in the middle. Everything is enough to say thank you. Every stage of the process. And even if, God forbid, the process is stillborn, we have to give thanks for what we have. That's the message of Dayenu, to give gratitude for everything. We don't have to wait. And that really is the reason we say it's Atchalta Degula, whatever you think about what's going on. But we can celebrate, even if it's not complete. But I'm saying, for the Torah to establish a separate holiday, that the Torah didn't want to do. This is my theory, that we don't have a special day for coming to the Latin Vision. You would think, we have a special day for when we left Egypt. Well, the purpose wasn't to leave Egypt. The purpose was to get to Israel. In order to get to Israel, we had to leave Egypt. But it's not leaving Egypt. It's coming to Israel. So you'd think we'd celebrate that. So I think by the Torah not, I don't know, that by the Torah not making a specific holiday, it's hinting to the fact that that really hasn't happened. We haven't fully conquered. We don't have peace. We have too many problems. We have to celebrate. We have to be thankful for what we have. But and in many ways, Sukkot is a celebration of the land of Israel. We do have other ways, all the agricultural festivals, all these things, Bikurim, they all celebrate the land. It's true, but we don't have a specific day. Oh, we arrived in Israel. No, we have a day. Our fruits are growing in Israel. Beautiful. Let's take him our first fruit to the temple. Oh, we have things. Let's give it to the Kohanim. Let's give it to the Levim. Let's share with the poor. Lekachik and Chapea. So we have all these mitzvot that celebrate Israel, but it's, you know, on a, not the grand, like, thing on Pesach. Oh, we left Egypt, and we have a whole Seder. You could think we could do the same thing when we arrive in Israel. I don't know. That's just a point you can feel free to disagree.
Rabbi, but before entering to Israel, they had two celebrations. They had a public Brit Milah.
Yeah.
And they had Pesach.
Yeah, so we don't have anything to commemorate that. Correct.
Yeah.
That's my point. So, but we don't commemorate that.
No, but they commemorate.
Yeah, they. Okay, of course. There are many things people do in history that were done at the time, but they're not done for future times. That's a very common thing. We have, anyways. Okay. So that's just a few points I wanted to make on the last day of Pesach is just the last day of Pesach, the 7-day holiday. Seven is the magic number, 7 weeks to Shavuot, right? Rosh Hashanah is the seventh month. The only holiday that doesn't have seven in it is Yom Kippur. I don't think there's any seven in Yom Kippur, and correct me if I'm wrong, because as I say, Yom Kippur is sort of a tragic holiday. It's a great opportunity, but the fact that there is Yom Kippur is because of the tragic events of the Chet Egel. So it's Pesach 7 days, 7 weeks of Shavuot. Rosh Hashanah is the seventh month. Sukkot is the seventh month, and 7 day holiday too. And Shmini Atzeret is the one day that we just revel. You know, we're going to have a long winter. Over 6 months, we have Pesach, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah. Now we've got nothing. And it's true, sort of. And, you know, we know with the relationship, you know, the agriculture, that's how we relate to God. We combine agriculture and history. The spring is we renew our relationship with God, right? So going to have a long winter ahead of us. So God says, before we do that, let's just join together for no reason, right? That's the best kind of party. The best way to buy a gift for your spouse, not just because it's your anniversary, for no reason, not birthday, not anniversary. That's the highest level of love. So that's, we spend Shminitz here, but that's not just because of Sukkot. It's relating to Pesach too, because Sukkot is the culmination of Pesach. The goal of Pesach is really to get to Sukkot, is to march to the land of Israel. Okay, let me just spend a few minutes, a couple points on Musaf. Please God, we'll continue our regular shiur on the Seder. You know, we're in the middle, Birkat Kriyat Shema on Friday morning. You know, by then you can put away all your dishes. You've had a bagel or two by 9:30 in the morning. So we'll continue with that on Friday. But let's just spend, I just want to say a cute thing in Lisbon. I hope it's not too complicated. I don't have my Birnbaum, you know, your Seder. Does anybody have a Birnbaum Seder handy? If you do, I'd like to do me a favor, because I don't see it in any of the new Sidurim, but I seem to remember as a kid, we say Mifnei Chateinu. So the Musaf of Yom Tov is very much talks about returning to the land of Israel. That's what it talks about. Exile, Mifnei Chateinu, Galinu Meyartzeinu, Vinit Rachakum Meyalamateinu. And the idea of Musaf on Shabbat, Musaf is just to remember and to pray for the restoration of the sacrifices. But we don't have this whole thing of we were exiled from the land and bring us back. That's not, we say, Visham Nasa, let us do it. But on Yom Tov, we have a whole long speech. Mivnei Chateinu Galinu Meyartzeinu, God should have mercy on us, rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, B'nei Beit HaKavavtila. It's all about coming, returning to the Beit HaMikdash, because that's what Yom Tov is. Yom Tov is Aliyah LaRegel. There is no mitzvah of going to the Beit HaMikdash on Shabbat. But the whole purpose of Yom Tov is Aliyah LaRegel. That's the Rav's famous line, why there's no Kabbalah Yom Tov. We have a Kabbalah Shabbos. True, it's only from the 16th century. But again, this is the way, you know. But the idea of Kabbalah Shabbos is we welcome God. We welcome the Shabbat Queen to our shuls. But the Beit HaMikdash is God's. God's shul, it's God's place. I will bring you to my house. So we don't welcome God to God's house. God welcomes us. So there's no Kabbalah Yom Tov, because only if you're the host you do a Kabbalah. That's what the Rav very beautifully explains, why there's no Kabbalah Yom Tov. So Yom Tov is all about coming to God's home, simcha, joy. And therefore, it's not surprising that the Musaf is going to focus on the theme of the loss of the Beit HaMikdash much more than on Shabbat. Now, okay. So we say, and now, why cannot we service God? Why are we unable to do lasot chovoteinu bebeit bechiratechem? At the beginning of the second paragraph after Kedusha. We were exiled because of our sins. I'm not starting with that at 10:18 in the morning. That requires at least a whole thing on its own. This idea, mivnei chateinu galinu meyartzeinu, the relationship between sin and exile and how that is or isn't true in the modern world. And obviously as all kinds of implications, all kinds of things. A very important discussion, but not for now. We were pushed far from our land. We are unable to go, to see. You should be seen. You should see and be seen. The Gemara interprets it's both. We should go to see God, so to speak, and we should be seen by God. They were and bowed down to do our obligations. They're the korbanot mainly. In the house that you have chosen, right? That's we always say the hamakom asher yivkar Hashem. That's the reference to the temple and Torah, the place that God has chosen. It never says it's Yerushalayim. It's where God chose it. In this great holy home that your name rests upon because of the hand that was, how do they translate? That was sent out against your sanctuary. Okay, Shanishtacha. So if I remember as a kid, I could be wrong. That's why I want somebody, if they have a Birnbaum Matzor, to look it up. That's what I used as a kid. There was in brackets, Shanishtacha or Hashlucha. Today, every sitter I open up says Shanishtacha. What's the difference? This I heard Rav Schachter explain to us one. So it just shows you the precision, how they put together our Seder. What's the difference, Shen Nishtalcha or Hashlucha? And if you can find me a Seder that says Hashlucha, I'll be very happy. Anybody? So Nishtalcha is in the past tense, and Hashlucha is in the present tense. Shen Nishtalcha b'mikdashecha. Right. Because of what happened 2,000 years ago in the year 70, the Romans destroyed the temple. We can't bring any korbanot. Hashlucha b'mikdashecha means I don't want to get into the politics of the situation, but for obvious reasons, we're not even allowed to pray on the Temple Mount right now. We can't, you want to start a world war, go build a Beit HaMikdash. But right now it's impossible. What's the difference? So Rav Shachter, this is a machloket, the Rambam and the Ravid. So, which is really the same machloket if you're allowed to go on the Temple Mount today, right? According to the Rambam, there's an Iser Karet. It's like eating chametz on Pesach. It's like eating on Yom Kippur. The prohibition to enter the Temple Mount, unless you are tahor, meaning with the paraduma, et cetera, means you are cut off from the Jewish people. So you might as well go eat matzah, go eat chametz on Pesach, which is why traditionally, Jews have not gone on Temple Mount, and why today in 2023, most rabbinic authorities forbid Jews to go on Temple Mount. However, according to the right, and again, I don't want to talk the politics of it, but obviously there are political implications and considerations, whatever. The right, why? Because according to the Rambam, the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash is still in existence. We still have the holiness of the temple. The fact that it was destroyed is not relevant. Kedusha Rishonah Kidsha Zmanah Kedusha Shniyah, the second holiness Kidsha Shata Ula Atid Lavo, for all time. And the Ravid disagrees. The Ravid says that's true, but Israel, but the Makom HaMikdash, the place of the temple, only has holiness if there's a temple. There's no temple, there's no holiness. So there's a debate within the Ravid. Does the Ravid just mean to say that there's no karet if you go there, you're not cut off, or it's totally permissible? But there are views that say, according to the Ravid, it's totally permissible. If I'm not mistaken, the Meiri in the Middle Ages writes that it was customary for those few Jews who lived in Israel, they would taka go on Har Bayit. They would walk there following the opinion of the Ravid, that it doesn't matter if you're Tamei, because there's no holiness to that place anymore. So the question is, why cannot we bring Korbanot anymore? Can we not bring Korbanot because the holiness was lost 2,000 years ago, and therefore we have no Kedusha to the Beit HaMikdash because it was destroyed? So therefore you can't bring the Korbanot. Or you say, no, in theory the Kedusha is there, but we can't bring it because right now, we're not in control of the Temple Mount. Or are we making a historical statement? We have an historical, and therefore now we have to suffer the consequences of history, so to speak. Or no, this is, who cares what happened 2,000 years ago? If we could reestablish whatever sovereignty, I'm not saying we should, don't there, I'm just saying, you know, there, then you could theoretically redo it. If I remember correctly, that was the difference. And that's why the old Sidurim used to write two girsaot, two versions. Some would say nishtalcha, and some say hashlucha. Today, it seems like everybody says she nishtalcha, which would go with why there's no holiness to the temple anymore. Maybe you can walk in there. But anyway, I just thought that was sort of an interesting idea, that little cute thing. I don't know if anybody made a little bit whatever, but on this one word, and you'll know, again, if anybody, I think it was in the old Birnbaum, the Siddur at both versions. I hope I'm not making this up, but that's the difference between, and I do remember hearing this from Rav Schachter many, many years ago, but the difference between Nishtalcha and Hashlucha. I'll just end the idea of Vatitei Lehu Shemakein Biyava. How do we start? This is the third paragraph. Atabach Artanu. It's also, we don't really say that on Shabbos, right? I'll add one thing. Okay. On the difference between Yontif and Shabbos. So you notice it says, so we talk, God loves us. Very important. We have to love God, and God has to love us. But titein lenu shen biyav, God through love, modim usimcha, and joyous times, chagim usmanim, time to festivals, Vasason, to rejoice, and then we say whatever the three festivals are, Chag HaMatzah, Chag HaShavuot, Chag Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeret, that's also. And on Shabbat, we say Ba'ahava Mikra Kodesh, and on Yom Tov, we don't say Ba'ahava, right? You have in your Machzor, right, whether we add on Shabbat the word Ba'ahava. There's greater love on Shabbat than, I would think, the opposite. On Yom Tov, we go to God's home. We're closer to God, the mitzvah of Simcha. You think there's a greater level of love on Yom Tov. But we add the word Ba'ahava on Shabbos. You're right, you know what I'm talking about. If not, open up your Siddur, and you'll see the word Ba'ahava is in brackets, right at the beginning of Musa. And they'll tell you on Shabbat, add the word in parentheses. Why do we add the word Ba'ahava on Shabbat? Anybody? See, that's why somebody wrote me a very nice email this week that they're happy we're in class 76 now on the weekly, and we're still in the middle of Shachri because there's so much beauty in every word of the Siddur, which we don't do all of them either, but hopefully some of them. So here I also heard from Rav Schachter, also explain this, that because on Shabbat there's no Korban Chatat, there's no sin offering. On Yom Tov, there's a sin offering. The same way we were discussing that Yom Kippur is like it's necessary and beautiful and happy, but it's also sad because we sin at the golden calf. So too, Yom Tov is happy, sason, simcha, beautiful, correct? Special laws of happiness that we don't even have on Shabbat. But love, Yom Tov, there's a lack of love. And we have to bring a sin offering. Why do we bring a sin offering? So this, because we threw Yosef in the pit. That's, and we, the tefillah, the first beginning of Karpas, right? They took his coat and they dipped it in the blood of a Seir. And what do we bring every Yom Tov? Seir is easy mechatat. You have to bring a goat, for a sin offering. So every Yom Tov, what about Egypt? Why do we have to leave Egypt? If we brothers wouldn't have sold Yosef, Yaakov's story in Laban's home, as I wrote last week, that could have been good enough. We wouldn't have need to go to Egypt. We would have Yaakov and Laban, that would have been the punishment and the fourth generation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Everything would have worked out perfectly. But it didn't happen that way. So every Yom Tov has a little bit of, it's the lack of love. No nahagu kavod zevazeh, like the Sfiras Omer. You know, the rabbis didn't, here, of course, it was also, I assume, much worse what the brothers did to Yosef. So therefore, we have to bring a sin offering. There's a, it takes away from the love. And therefore, on Shabbat, when there's only two olot, but no schatat, we say baba. I don't know. I thought that's a very nice explanation. But, anyways, it's, like everything. We grow. We learn from our mistakes. That's the whole purpose. That's what all the holidays, that's what tshuva, that's what, in spirits, we're supposed to learn to get along, to honor one another, and we're supposed to learn on Yom Tov not to fight among each other. That's why it's so important on Yom Tov to invite people. That's the whole notion of Yom Tov, giving to the poor. It's the embrace. It's the coming together of the Jews, because Yom Tov began, Zecher Litzim Mitzrayim begins with the brothers who are split. So it's got to end with the brothers coming all together. Okay, let's just do a quick review and then I'll take any question. We discussed that there is no reason in the Torah for the seventh day of Pesach. No reason other than it's the seventh day of Pesach. And seven is the key number. The two most important holidays of the year, Pesach and Sukkot, have 7 days. And therefore, we have the first day Yom Tov, the last day Yom Tov. On Sukkot, we added, quote unquote, an eighth day to commemorate all the holidays, a special day, not just the end of Sukkot, the end of all the holidays, just to revel in God's presence. It's hard for me to separate, and therefore there is no special mitzvah, just to be joy. So we didn't need 2 days of Yom Tov in a row, right? That's only in Chutz La'aretz, and then that can turn into a 3-day Yom Tov. But so that's 7 days, and the commandment to keep was given before Kriyat Yom Tov. Many great events that happen in Jewish history are not commemorated directly as a holiday, perhaps Matan Torah, in the Torah at least, as we said, the falling of the man, even though that's the origins of Shabbat, it's not connected in any way later on to the reasons we keep Shabbat. The arrival in the land of Israel is not celebrated. So that we said perhaps because we haven't fully arrived yet. I mean, that we're still in the process of Yetzir Mitzrayim. We left Egypt long ago, but we're still working our way towards Eretz Yisrael. I think that's an important idea. But Sukkot and Pesach are the twin pillars of the year. And the goal of Pesach is Sukkot. The goal of leaving Egypt is to get to Israel. And we saw three places already by the Brit Ben Haptarim at the burning bush and the question of the wise child, that the idea that God took us out of Egypt, not to give us the Torah, but to take us to Israel. Yeah, the Torah is very important. I want to, God forbid, minimize. Torah is b'yem chayenu v'rechameinu, but that's really the means to an end. That's the mechanism by which we're going to set up the state. But the goal is to set up a moral, ethical, prosperous, successful state in the land of Israel. The Torah is the way we do it. But we have to do it in a way that the non-Jews are impressed. And that's why Israel is never mentioned in any of these places. We spoke a little on Sfira of the context of the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva is in the context of having children when you're young and children when you're old, and teaching Torah when you're young and teaching Torah when you're old, because Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 of his students and he recreated Torah from these five students. And we said, whether it's literal or not, and it's 12 pairs of 24,000, well, 12,000 pairs of 24, it's a weird way. And I thought that may be a reference to the 12 years and 12 years of Rabbi Akiva learning. And it's also the 24 years, 24,000 students. The comparison to Moshe Rabbeinu, only him and Moshe could separate from their wives. That would be a terrible thing for other people to do. But the Talmud never, it's only later on as a postscript, it says it happened at this time of year in Sfira, but the Talmud never actually says, therefore, we mourn, which it does for the destruction of the temple, where it says, oh, the temple was destroyed, therefore, we have these laws that we're going to keep. Talmud doesn't say that right here. So that's why perhaps the Crusades is the real reason that Sfira became what it did, where it's meant to be a long Chol HaMoed, as the Ramban says, meant to be a long Chol HaMoed between Pesach and Shavuot. Then we discussed a little bit in Musaf. Obviously, Musaf is esteemed much more in the temple, because Musaf is all about, Yontif is all about going to the Beit HaMikdash, Aliyah L'Rego, so that becomes a major theme. And we talked about whether the problem of not bringing sacrifice because of what happened or what is happening, past or present, whether the Kedusha of the temple still exists, and that the extra love, there's extra joy perhaps on Yontif, but extra love on Shabbat because there are no sin offerings. No sin offerings. So we always have to remember that Yontif is the time we have to come together as a people, and we have to do that all year. After the Kashel, I prayed at them. It's the same thing God says. That's what I heard from J.J. Schechter, actually. God says, it's hard for me to separate from you. Let's have an extra day. That's Shmini Atzeret. But Kashel, I prayed at them can also mean it's hard for me, for God, when the Jewish people are separate. Prayed at them, when the Jewish people are fighting, it's very hard for God. And we have to keep that in mind. We don't want God to have to suffer because we don't get along. So anyways, thank you. Let me see if there are any questions, and then please, God, we'll see you on Friday, and then we'll send out, I guess on Friday we'll send out, our regular shiur will be continuing, adding a couple in, but we'll let you know everything. But if so many students were deserving of death, that diminishes the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. In other words, Rabbi Akiva couldn't influence his students. That's a very interesting point. Probably some truth to that. Maybe Rabbi Akiva didn't realize what was going on. Maybe because he spent 24 years away not interacting with people. I don't know. That's a very interesting point, right? A student, although you can't always blame the teacher for the acts of the students, but yes, he had to suffer too. Same way that Moshe Rabbeinu was held a little bit responsible for how the Jewish people acted. That is true. That's a fascinating point to think about a little more. Ezra Sofer also, that is correct. Ezra, Moshe, Rabbeinu, and Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara says there are four people who lived to 120. I think Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is the fourth one. I don't know if Ezra's in that list. I have to look it up. There are really five, but the Medrash in Parshat Hazinu mentions four, I believe. And they divide their lives into 40, 40, 40, right? Moshe, the first, they divide it, with Moshe, it's not so clear, but they still divide 40, 40, 40. It came at 80. And Rabbi Akiva, of course, the first 40 years was he was in ignoramus. The second 40 years, he learned Torah. The third 40 years is when he taught this 40, which is a number of transformation. Again, it doesn't have to be literal. Maybe he learned a 38 or 41. That's not the point, but absolutely we're comparing Rabbi Akiva to Moshe and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. These were the people who saved Torah at critical moments in Jewish history. Ezra, after the destruction, coming back to Israel, saved Torah. Obviously Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai at the point of destruction of Rabbi Akiva, the Adriatic persecution. These were all moments of crisis in Jewish history where Judaism was held in the balance. We didn't know what was going to happen. Okay, so that's why they're being compared. Yeah, if Moshe Rabbeinu hadn't been around, that is correct. The famous Gemara in Sanhedrin that the Torah should have been given to Ezra, but what can we do? Moshe Rabbeinu beat him to it. We don't have time now, but it's a Gemara worth discussing on another occasion. The Gemara then says, therefore, they changed the font of the Torah. The original Torah, at least according to many opinions, was given what's called Ketav Ivrit, like hieroglyphics, like very, you couldn't read it. I couldn't read one word of it. And the font was changed, what we call Ketav Ashurit. That's what we have today, because so it's like a new Torah. It's not fair. Moshe Rabbeinu beat Ezra to it. That's like a historical, couldn't control it. But that is what the Gemara says, that Ezra was worthy to get the Torah, but it was already given to Moshe. So instead, we changed the font of the Torah. The Crusades affected Ashkenazi Jewry, right? They do have the same, right? Which I was thinking of that too. Thank you very much. The Sephardim do have it. I don't know if they have it less, if somebody can tell me. So clearly, the Crusades wouldn't have impacted them as much, or they wouldn't have memorialized it as much. And maybe they focus more on Rabbi Akiva. That's a point that I don't know exactly how to fully explain that. And maybe I don't think it disproves the thesis totally. That's because of the Crusade, but it is interesting. Yeah, the Sephardim do have, if anybody who is Sephardi can tell me a little bit more, I would appreciate that. Okay. Well, Chanukah and Purim are during the long winter. They're just rabbinic, right? And not Chumash. That's correct. And Purim it's already Purim sort of the beginning of spring. Chanukah is dafk in the winter. That's why it's a holiday of light. That's why we like lights on Chanukah, because Chanukah is right. That's the whole exception. But Chanukah is specifically a winter holiday, right? Or both Nishtacha. Fine. It's not in the version of Birnbaum that I have. Okay. Somebody wrote to me privately. Okay. We show our love to God by resting. But we show our love on Yontiv when we come to the Beit HaMikdash, I think. Our initiative, I think. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.
I have two very quick questions.
Sure.
The idea of not celebrating coming to Israel, the arrival in Israel, is that maybe why there's a machlokas over the drinking of the fifth cup?
Right. So I think Rabbi Leo Kitov suggested we drink a fifth cup. I don't know, does anybody drink a fifth cup in Israel? I'm not up on this. Or maybe some people do, right? Because they made the fifth cup. The truth of the matter, the idea of that the four votes, Seitivit, Salti, Vigalti, Vilakati, that's our four languages of redemption, is really a later day interpolation. Why we have four cups of wine. Even though that's the reason everybody's taught in kindergarten, the more standard, the more reason that they really talk about it, because there are four parts of the Seder. There's Kiddush, Magid, Benching, Birchat HaMazon, and Hallel. And each one of those, Kiddush and Birchat HaMazon always have a kus, even though we don't do it, but Birchat HaMazon does. Hallel also should have a kus. We have a wedding, a Brit, we have a kus, and the Haggadah, which is a form of Hallel, has a kus. That's why there are four kusot. It's not so much because there are five lishonot, and therefore, so there was a machloket, right? There is a machloket in Talmud now in the fifth. I forget, where is that? By Nishman, I forget already. So that the Gemara says, we don't know if we drink a fifth course. So that's what they say, like, Teku leaving for Eliyahu, and then some say, I don't know, I thought I had heard that Eliyahu Kitov said when they come back to Israel, drink a fifth cup, but I really don't know. And if anybody knows anybody in Israel who does, I should try to check into that and find out.
My second question is sort of unrelated to anything you talked about. If I would have been put in the Middle Ages, in the old Jewish community of Jerusalem, would they have kept one day Yom Tov then, or what?
Yeah. In Israel, kept one day Yom Tov. As a matter of fact, they even kept, according to some, I mean, there were never so many Jews living in Israel, but they may have even been keeping one day of Rosh Hashanah, maybe as late as the 11th, 12th century. The question is, when did 2 days Rosh Hashanah become universal in Israel? Because, you know, but yes, they always only kept one day of Yom Tov in Israel. And for a long period, even perhaps for a while on Rosh Hashanah, they kept one day, right? So okay, everybody, thank you, everybody, have a wonderful Yom Tov, last days of Yom Tov. Please God, we'll see you Friday morning at the continuing back to our Siddur class, and always invite a friend, enjoy, and should hear good things. We should b'nisan nigalub, and please God, b'nisan atidim or hovim nigael. Okay. Chag Sameach, everybody. Bye-bye.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.